Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hello, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is John Steven, and I'm founding principal at Edify Security. I've spent the last two and a half decades helping define the software security space and helping organizations build their security practices, as well as helping vendors build some of the tools you may have used to do security in your code bases. I'd like to introduce you to Jim Manico, who I've known for the better part of that two decades. We met each other in a room, which we entered to fight about what the correct answer to cross-site scripting was, and then further spend the day fighting about whether or not developers could fix their own code, or if we as security people had to do it. And 20 years later, a lot has changed in terms of our perspective on that, and that's what I'm here to talk about. Jim is, in his own right, what I like to call a security magpie, somebody who has circled security spaces and developer spaces and picked up all of the good bits off of that chaotic beach of good and bad advice. And he is the CEO and founder of Manicode, where he delivers, in my opinion, some of the best training out there in terms of developer-centric building security in across languages and across spaces. Jim, do you want to say anything else about yourself?
I'll say something about you, John. John was one of the principals, internal CTO at Cigital. It was one of the biggest application security firms in our industry. And John did a lot of work behind the scenes, empowering people around him, working with some of the biggest companies in the world with application security. I'm just a fan of your career, John, and the number of people you've mentored the last 20 years. So it's a pleasure to be here with you, and I'm looking forward to your questions.
Likewise, in reverse, which probably won't come through as we fight like cats and dogs.
Bring it on, John.
But so I want to start with kind of as I began to speak in the industry in communities like the OWASP community, which was security practitioners. I was a big proponent of you have to understand the code better. If you don't understand the dev frameworks, then you're really not going to provide decent remediation advice, and you may be flat out wrong. You'll recall that in the beginning, I spent a lot of time trying to explain to that community that, fixing cross-site scripting wasn't an input validation problem, but it was about output encoding and those things. And that, those were controversial. Now, the way I look at the space, I see something of a sea change over the last 3 years, and it's really undeniable now. Yeah. Developers in many security organizations have said, we're done waiting for security to solve these problems. Your tools were too error prone and too painful to use, and your advice was too hand wavy. We got this now. Yeah. We're going to build the security controls. We're going to define the security activities. We're going to score and figure out whether to release. And you can record what we do and report it up however you want. Security really has changed that much. You've been there the whole time. We both have a lot of gray hair. What do you think? What do you think about that trend? And what is the developer's role in an organization's security program? How are they to think about this sea change and participate in it constructively?
The word that keeps coming to mind when you ask this question, John, is DevOps. I really think that's the convergence of what we did good in security, removing what we did bad in security, and getting developers more involved to build that capability. And what I mean by that is there's a few things I think are critical. Number one is blocking me at check-in from finishing that check-in, from merging it completely until I finish security testing. And DevOps-style security testing is meant to be very lightweight. It runs in under 30 seconds. It's meant to be low fidelity, multiple low fidelity tools that run fast, but give me at least a little assurance at this critical juncture of checking in code. Those who are mature at DevOps also build pre-commit hooks where I have to run certain tools locally before I'm even allowed to commit. And very often this tool chain is built by developers for developers. I think that's the best when I'm using Jenkins or GitHub automation or something else to maintain and automate my own testing environment led by devs, assisted by security. So now I can build, scan, and deploy code on my own and get security out of the way. Now, there's fragility with this. There's problems with this. But that kind of thinking where I want to do security, I want to have reasonable gates and get security people out of the way, I think that's a real big piece in how application security has matured. Still gives me significant capability as a developer to get my job done, but stops me when there's a problem. So that's a big piece of how things have gotten more serious in the last 3 years.
And this is security FUBU, you know, right? Security FUBU. This is security for us and by us as developers.
Exactly.
And it's going to help me move quicker. And I understand my code, so maybe I make better decisions. But isn't this the wolf watching the hen house?
A little bit. This is why I think if developers only establish the pipeline, it's going to be a little bit it's going to be weaker than if security influences it. Now, here's where developers like to do pipeline work. I'll automate the scanners you need me to run, and I'll automate the live deployment. I'll automate all these pieces. You know what developers don't like, though? They don't like pre-commit hooks. This is forcing me to run certain security tools before I'm allowed to check in, and developers hate being blocked at check-in. They hate being stopped from completing their merge. And so usually if devs build the pipeline by themselves, pre-commit hooks and commit blocking at security testing is gone. And when
I'm a little bit confused because now I think you're talking out of both sides of your mouth. So
absolutely,
I want to gate the commit, but I'm going to get mad if I gate the commit. And so there's subtlety here. I think the point you're making here is that to get this correct culturally, you really need to understand the way that people's Git flows work, how they actually operate inside of the repository workflows, and what the specific phases of branch strategy is. This branch means it's going to be automatically promoted by orchestration software into production.
Yes.
So that one I gate, whereas my private branches, I want to be able to play with in my playground, and I'm going to be highly aggravated if you impede my progress. And so what is, I think that's something, I mean, obviously, you know, you and I were a little bit of a standout inside the security practitioner space early on because we would always introduce ourselves with the caveat, whether it was a badge of honor or a badge of, you know, shame that like we're developers in this space and we feel like visitors. But so what is the security person's, how did they understand this nuance? How do they get enough literacy to participate in those DevOps cultures and practices and hang? Because honestly, I feel like that's one of the biggest challenges is the cultural imperative of DevOps has said, you know, you two brothers need to play together.
Yeah.
But they don't necessarily know how to play together well.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Should I be excited or afraid of AI? The answer is yes, it's both.
Things are gonna look so different in the next couple years. You will not be ready for the disruptions that are going to come.
I'm Jeff Nielsen, host of Digital Disruption, the go-to podcast for technology leaders.
Our generation's conflict, I think, is gonna be emotional, not economic.
The companies that are going to win are the ones that have a couple of characteristics.
Stay ahead of the curve with Digital Disruption, available now on your favorite podcast platform.
Where I've seen the most success at developers and traditional application security working together to accomplish these security and dev goals, it's strangely like a lot of the original DevOps thinkers would say, oh, you don't want to have DevOps as a service. And I look back 10 years and I'm like, well, that's exactly what we need in my opinion. Yes. DevOps as a service is outstanding, I think, because I don't want 50 teams all building their own pipeline from scratch. That's a huge waste. So I like having a service-based DevOps team that includes developers and a security person who collaborate together. Usually it's a security person who's leading DevOps pipeline management and creation team, but his team is a pack of developers who need to actually work on the pipeline. And by the way, programming and scripting the pipeline is it's more difficult than writing the application itself. There's so much subtle nuance in this. It's not even a lot of code. It's just really specific code.
So, highly parametric, highly meta. Yeah. I almost you can tell a maturity of a security initiative. And in fact, if you look at the BSIM study, which I've helped author, it's a survey of what people are doing. There are literally sort of factions of survey respondents.
Yes. Absolutely.
And the faction of survey respondents that says, we implement security through our platform team, which does repo as a service and pipeline as a service.
Yep.
You get a fundamentally different physics. To your point, I mean, I think as a security executive, I'm not sure how you report effectively across 3,000 application teams without some kind of standardization on that reporting.
Exactly.
Which isn't going to come out of your security tools as easily unless you've standardized the way your pipelines can, execute and consume the results from them. I think that there's a challenge here, and I think that this challenge is kind of a proxy of the challenge we had 2 decades ago. 2 decades ago, security people didn't understand enough about code to understand the root cause and the fix, and developers didn't understand the security issues. Now the tooling has become more developer-centric. The security people have understood it's about the code a bit more, but there's still that language barrier, okay? And so
I agree.
How does development and security, what are things that they can do tomorrow to get, if they don't have a platform team or if they're just an individual contributor, to make that, team that maybe their peer more effective and get this turned on or get it prototyped and get progress? What is the thing you look for as, okay, they're going to learn how to share the toys in the pipeline?
That's a hard question. Let me see if I can sum your question is, I'm a lone developer without a product team. There's a couple AppSec guys maybe trying to get me to scan stuff. What can you do as a single contributor to actually help security? I think a good first step is a lot of developers are under the influence of assessment technology that they can skip.
Lovely.
It's just that as a developer, when I'm confronted with non-blocking application security assessment technology, I got to use it. And first of all, I shouldn't have that choice. I should have a pipeline that's set up for me that forces me to go through security gates. But guess what? No one likes gates. So very often, developer, I have assessment technology as a service available to me. So the first thing I should do is actually use that service. I should actually suck it up, run the
standards. So pick up the toys off the floor and start putting them into my automation pipeline and saying, this is my telemetry. This is what I see. What do you guys think?
And a lot of developers don't want to do that. They think it's a waste of their time. And I want to convince, and it is a big hit of time to start to mature and tune even the most basic application security tools. So number one is, work with your security team, go through the assessment technology. It's brutal, but do it. I think the second thing is to make recommendations on tooling. Like, I don't want to use Fortify anymore, John, not in a DevOps lifecycle. I want to use SemGrep. I don't want to use tools that take me 20 minutes to run. I want tools that run fast for the initial pipeline and take traditional tools like Fortify and put those post-deployments that can run all day if it needs to. And guess what? That's hard for a developer. So let me rewind. Let me rewind from that. Let me go back to your question. What can I do as a developer? I would start in two areas. I would start with the simple vulnerability that it's easy to identify and fix, like SQL injection, and go through all of my SQL queries and look at that. That's real tangible. It's basic, assuming I'm even doing SQL, but that's one vulnerability I can thoroughly investigate and fix and understand my ability to find, fix, and deploy a single bug. And that's an easy one to fix. On the other end, I want to get my authentication code dialed in. I want to make, if I'm using OpenID Connect, I want to really make sure I got that connector done right. If I'm doing my own manual password storage, I want to review like the app, like one of the projects I work on, John, is the application security verification standard. It's a little messy, don't get me wrong, but I would look at the ASVS requirements or NIST 863 special application and look at my authentication layer. That's the harder place to start. SQL injection is a simple place to start, but I would try to address individual vulnerability categories and try to root cause them. And
yeah,
here's one last thing and I'll stop. There is no good answer to this question. If I'm a lone developer with no product security team, weak AppSec, and no real support, there's a heavy limit to what I can do and be effective, because AppSec is a team sport. I need resources and compatriots and expertise to really do it.
This goes back to the aphorism of don't try to boil the ocean, right? So if you can implement a freely available tool and you can find that tool, not because you're an expert or, you know, versed in the space, but because you Googled something that helps you with a particular problem you're concerned about or feel like is endemic, then you can campaign that problem and you can build towards, a comprehensive approach with individual tools and individual campaigns. And I think that's a great way to do it. Switching gears a bit, we think about code and you mentioned things like SQL injection. You mentioned the ASVS, which really focuses on the kinds of problems that developers can introduce by coding.
Yeah.
10 years ago, we recognized, well, wait a minute, a lot of what developers are doing is actually downloading and implementing open source. So maybe we should look at that open source and see if it's the latest version or if it's got malware in it or if it's patched or what the deal with that is. And so we built composition analysis tools.
That
kind of shifted our software security down the stack. And, recently we've started using things like Kubernetes and then service mesh orchestration like CIO and others. And so not only did we have open source self-service, coding by downloading somebody else's stuff, but we have self-service infrastructure in terms of infrastructure as code, Terraform, Ansible, and then self-service workload orchestration, Kubernetes, self-service application, orchestration with Istio. All of that ends up being configuration and code. And so in some sense, just as the security vendors have clued in and said, oh my gosh, shift left, it's the code. We've been telling them this for decades, but they finally figured out that they need to be able to read and understand and fix source code. Now the source code is migrating to the right.
Yeah.
And so more and more of what we do to make applications happen in production is source code. And there's all of these different formats popping up like mushroom patches everywhere in the DevOps, in that middle ground, and to the operations and maintenance pieces. What does that do to what we thought about as application and software security? Well, and how does a developer respond to that? And how does a security person respond to that?
I believe we're in the sixth wave of migration when it comes to moving to cloud services, John. The first wave was like, I'm using basic Amazon infrastructure. I have to do a lot of the work myself still. I'm using services, first getting into the cloud. But we're at a whole new level now where we see like in all three of the major providers, GCP, Azure, and AWS, I got full infrastructure capability scripted now. And I have to do a lot of that myself, right? I have to maintain a script or deliver my own code. And it's a lot of the same problems as traditional software because I have to manage it myself. But John, I'm going to change your conversation. We're beginning to move into the third wave of migration for cloud services. And here's the difference. I can go to Azure right now, set up a master key, click, and I got a master key now in my hardware security module. I then go build a data level key with Azure storage, click, and I'm done. I then can encrypt data and have it go to Azure storage while the actual encryption data key, encrypted by the key encrypting key in an HSM at Azure, will go back to my vault. And click, 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 I have an extremely mature key management lifecycle and an extremely mature data level encryption mechanism, and I'm 2 minutes in. Until the cloud gives me controls at that level, which is happening now, it is all coming into place now. And that's going to save us, John. That's going to give me the ability to build a security layer that a million developers can benefit from. Click, click, click. And so we're between that second and third wave of migration. If you're stuck in the second wave where you're managing scripts and managing code and building it all from scratch, you got the same traditional AppSec problems in a different location, in your YAML file, in your infrastructure scripting file. And all the scanners can actually start to understand a little bit of that now. But until we move to standardized architectures, which is what, and standardized security capabilities, which is happening all over the place now, we're going to be in this, we're going to be in the same morass problem of scanning, fixing, assessing. Because
the enabling security controls that are provided, in particular around identity and around encryption,
off the chart,
and around centralized logging and monitoring are really valuable.
Yeah.
Each of these cloud service providers are doing a great job, and I don't want to denigrate any of them, but each of them has gaps.
Absolutely.
And so what you described with Azure in particular is something I've experienced, which is very easy to segment, least privilege, compartmentalize, persistence-based keys for my data stores in Azure. Maybe not as easy on something like AWS. Maybe AWS does, something else better. How does a developer, interface with, now the thousands of lines of infrastructure as code or externalized cloud configuration as, as a flat file and figure out where their CSP and their use of the CSP has provided them a huge lift that they need to replicate team to team as that secure template and where it might be a gap that reflects an open situation in their architecture. How do they navigate that?
When you say CSP, I always think of content security policy. I know you're using
cloud service provider.
Gotcha. I'm sorry. I'm stuck in web security world. So is your question, how does a developer navigate all the complexities and nuances available at a cloud service provider?
That's a shorter way to put it. And how do they figure out what the cloud service provider has done well? This is the thing, right? So with Azure, the example you gave, the best thing a developer might be able to do is say, you know what? I'm going to push all of my key management and my persistent encryption to the Azure controls. And that's going to take a ton of work off my plate and give me a really hard posture. With another cloud service provider, they may not have that same kind of ease and strength. All of the cloud service providers are doing a great job across the board, but of course, each of them does it sort of differently, and there's sort of rough edges and gaps in each that just don't match up. Right?
How about this?
So how does the developer consume what is in essence hundreds of security controls and get themselves to a level of literacy where they can tackle? What techniques do you suggest they use there to navigate that?
Take my classes.
Take your class?
Take my class. But let me give you, that's part of the answer is, I'm not saying take my class. I'm saying get educated. Go take a modern AWS security class if you're an AWS shop. But let's go back to Azure for a second. Even in Azure, where I can do really good data cryptography with key management in a click, you can still choose to use the user-managed HSMs in Azure. You could still use their managed HSM, but you have the ability to write keys to the HSM as opposed to having Azure-managed keys. So if you go Azure-managed and Azure-created keys, turnkey easy, you don't get a copy of the key. And that's best practice. Some companies hate that, so they want to manage the keys themselves. Some companies want to manage their own dedicated HSM in the cloud. So the point is, even when you have the secure option, click, click, I got data storage and key management, there are other options that are going to be less secure because these cloud providers want to provide flexibility. And that's the problem. There's a secure option, but every cloud provider gives me insecure options. So how do I make the right choices architecturally and get security when cloud is not mono? It gives me an infinite number of configuration possibilities. And that, John, there's no easy answer for. You need to have a solid architect. You need an Amazon architect, or be willing to take Amazon education, which hundreds of companies offer. And you got to have real modern knowledge of what the cloud providers provide at a software engineering level. And I see some of my customers where they have that expertise in-house, and some where they're fumbling along, figuring it out as they go. And that's the problem. Last thought here, if I want good AppSec, if I want good development, I need a framework and cloud expert, embed it with my team if that's what I'm doing every day.
And that's let me contextualize this a bit for a second here, because we started off in pipelines with tools and we said, you know what, DevOps is really helping me out because I can use these freely available open source tools, things like SemGrep and others. I can push that into my pipeline. I can pick those for myself. I can campaign the vulnerability types that bother me or that are prevalent, and I'm going to make progress. We talked about code moving into infrastructure as code and that shift to the cloud. And we said, look, you know, the strength and quantity of the controls that the cloud service providers are providing means I don't have to worry about those implementation bugs as much, maybe.
Right.
But I've got a design problem. I need to know if I'm solving against somebody driving a forklift into the data center and pulling the disks, or if I need to manage an escrow of the keys for my customers on an individual basis.
Bingo.
And so I need design level competence inside the cloud and knowledge. And so I've got my pipeline, and me and my other peer developers are building sort of a pipeline as a service or a repo as a service that I feel good about with those little checks on it. How does, and you talked about the OWASP community and what security practitioners have done with things like ASVS, writing an encyclopedia of checks that one needs to make.
Right.
But this, I do think the CS, you know, the space of the cloud design really does change that game, to your point.
I agree.
Terms like threat modeling come into play.
Yep.
You know, like
I was just about to go there.
How do we as developers think about the design level challenges? I mean, because look, getting certified as an Amazon security architect takes
years,
right? Like this is not an small undertaking, right? So
years.
So what do I do, you know, in the next 12 months to feel good about myself and to make progress incrementally, like we talked about campaigning the individual bugs with the free tools.
Let me go back to the bugs and free or cheap or even expensive tools. The tools are getting really good at understanding YAML file problems, technical bugs in cloud configuration. Those tools have come out. All these cloud visibility tools, even Kubernetes, there's multiple products. My buddy's at KSOC. Hey, Jimmy, I'm part of a Kubernetes security company that gives deep analysis into esoteric cloud configuration. So that technical cloud scanning, it's there now. It's all there. But to your point, that doesn't help me make good decisions in assembling the architecture of my software. And your question is, how do I do that? Well, good luck. There's no easy answer to that, John. We talk about threat modeling, but that's not even helping me pick something good. Threat modeling and design review helps me understand if the design that I chose has got reasonable security. What threat modeling doesn't do is help me understand all the components available at AWS or all the components available at Azure and how to assemble them together. Threat modeling does not give me that. Threat modeling doesn't help me understand the AWS inventory. Again, I'll make my choices, and then threat modeling and design review will vet that those choices I made in theory were decent. So we're back to the problem of I got AWS, I got Azure. I don't touch GPC. It's crap. Sorry. But I'm going to use non-GPC, Azure or AWS.
GCP. I think GCP is doing some really interesting things with security, actually. I think
totally.
I think that they're an interesting challenger.
But go ahead. It's unusable, though, compared to AWS. This is my opinion. AWS is built for the everyman. Azure is built for the Microsoft community, and GPC is meant for Google PhDs who are real pedantic and don't care about smooth usability like AWS or Azure does. And you know what? GPC has its place. If I was like a scientific community, a group of senior developers, some of their capability is outstanding, but it's unusable crap for
Let me
it's unusable, John. PhDs, I know you love that stuff. That's your crack. I know, John. But
I represent
the every man and every woman, John, and I will not touch GPC because it's not for everyone. It's for PhDs only.
Your opinion's noted. So what I really like about what Phil and others are doing at GCP is that they are trying to transition from a shared responsibility model, which I basically affectionately refer to as like you're screwed and it's your fault, right? And to a shared fate model. And they're coming out with security blueprints that try to solve the problem of here are the security controls that we provide, and here's how we want you to build systems using them. Ooh. And so they're doing it in a very prescriptive, opinionated fashion. And you know, think about the Linux distributions, right? There are Linux distributions that are not opinionated, and there are ones that are very opinionated. Yeah. And people have a preference. But GCP is going to be an opinionated, secure cloud.
I'm interested.
It is going to provide people a paved road to deliver quickly on. And, you know, we'll see. But each of them has, there are things to love and hate about each. Anyways, let's go back to the, to the question at hand here. So does, you know, there was a lot in application security that was art, and we bemoaned writing tools and writing guidance as a community to make that art practicable by individual practitioners and developers. You really think that designing these secure systems is still an art? Now, one of the things that I like to teach when I teach threat modeling is that you have to understand the dev frameworks.
I agree.
You have to understand the cloud controls and the way that orchestration works.
Well said.
In fact, I have a whole day of training on those aspects of it.
I'm with you.
Because I think if you don't, then you don't get down to the level of detail. Now, it's unsurprising that a common complaint of my training is that it's maybe too technical. I even had a developer say, I have to understand code to do this, which I found fascinating. You are a developer, right? But I think that's just another, you know, testament to it. This can be challenging. I think there are things though that make this easier. And whether it's Azure best practices, whether it's Amazon well architected, or whether it's GCP security blueprints, all of them are taking the stance of here's the security controls I'm providing.
Yes.
And here's how I think you should use them. Here's what they provide.
Yes.
This is going to, so I think that we are at that cusp that you described where people can take the cloud documentation and begin to understand their security properties in a way that they haven't before. And I think that's exciting. I agree with you that the scanning technology in IAC is really interesting and can help you kind of see if people are on the paved road or not. And I think that's actually interesting. And it's why I took the time to mention what GCP is doing, because whether it's, again, Azure best practices or Amazon well architected, if you as a developer can say, I've read their documentation and I understand what they want me to do or what they think is what they've threat modeled. So I can stand on the shoulder of a giant. Now I can use my freely available IAC scanning tool to see if I'm on the paved road or if I'm bushwhacking.
Yeah.
And if I'm bushwhacking, then I may have to call the security people. But if I stay on the paved road, then I'm probably going to be able to floor it. And move as fast as I want. And so I actually think that using the cloud service provider's security patterns and using the freely available tools to check your configuration to see if you're on the paved road is a powerful combination.
Absolutely.
That allows you to appear like you understand the threat model, even if you're just standing on the back of what Google, you know, Amazon or Azure security architects have provided, or your own, you know, your own best practices and reference architecture in your own organization. So that would be my answer to that. And I think it's,
I like it.
I think, but let's shift here because we have little time left and I want to talk about this. We've talked about code. We've talked about design.
One comment. You look at something like Angular, and that's a very specific paved road that's much more expensive to maintain because they specify the Angular way to do things. And it's secure and it's rigorous, but it gives me no flexibility. And so this is the trade-off. Migration into very specific architectures is going to save security, John. It's going to be the first time we really move forward in application security at the expense of innovation, though. The more you give me constrained reference architectures to work with, the less I can do flexible things. So that's the yin and the yang here. You start giving me very specific controls and very specific ways to build things, you're gonna really direct me to building software a very specific way. And some developers will be upset because it constrains innovation. That's why Angular's dropping out. Everyone likes Svelte and React now. Those are open frameworks, easier to screw up on. So that's, that's the yin and the yang.
I totally agree. And I think that'll be a pendulum, right? Spring Boot was very open. And, you know, then people went to Angular and now they're swinging back. And we're gonna see that.
Go for it, sir.
The thing I wanted to get to is whether you're a security person or a developer, everything implied by what we've talked about thus far means that your job is continuing education. You know, my dad was a pharmacist.
Sorry.
I never understood why every so many weeks he was doing so much homework, Dad. You know, and he was doing continuous education because drugs kept coming out and he needed to understand, you know, safe dosage, you know, misuse, all those things. That doesn't hold a candle to what you have to learn in terms of orchestration frameworks, development frameworks, cloud service providers, security controls.
I agree.
You are the definitive opinion on, in my mind, range of training from packaged services and computer-based, you know, capabilities to the highest end, you know, bespoke artistic mentorship and, shared, pata shaping. I don't know, whatever, but, very intimate training. So how does the security practitioner, and they both have different challenges.
Yeah.
Keep up with what the pace of changes.
This is so important, John. I'm going to say some things here. When in your team of developers, if you don't have an AppSec person or somebody with AppSec knowledge embed it with you, your chance of getting good security drops to zero fast. And I'll say the same thing about a framework. If you don't have someone on your team who has deep expertise in whatever framework you're using, Django, Strut, Spring, whatever, your chance of security or even good development drops to zero fast. So what if you don't have the expertise? So what I usually do is I instruct one of my customers. I'm like, let's go find someone who's a core committer to talk to us about what we should, to analyze our stuff. So we do that. They're like, hey, they're $1,000 an hour. I'm like, get them for a week. Who cares? Bringing that core committer of that framework in, like one of the Spring core committers or similar, and have them analyze our work, our chance of having, or whatever it takes to make sure we bring in the best expert we can find at that framework to help set policies for my developers. John, that's fundamental. And if I can't afford that on the other end, I'll just start with framework hardening guidelines and really make sure at least a couple members of my team are dedicated to understanding that framework. And John, we haven't even got to how to secure that framework yet. So I think this is one of the biggest problems. Just we'll start with Spring, my thing, right? Understanding the details of Spring takes a long time. It's manically complex. I don't care how you get it. You're probably going to get it through a consultant, through finding the right consultant who's done Spring for 15 years. But you need that framework expertise in-house. I don't care how you get it, whether you can hire some magic person, whether you bring in a consultant, have a retainer, go get one of the core committers and like kidnap them until they get the information out of them. Just release them blindfold so they don't know where they are. But however you do it, you need that deep framework expertise to have any chance of success in software development.
So this echoes
at the hard one, John.
So this yeah, but it's funny. This echoes, you know, when there's a video of me on the internet giving the first talk on threat modeling, and I don't have a beard. I look 12. You know, in three quarters of that video, I'm talking about understanding frameworks, and it was just years before people understood. Like, why is he like? Is he just off in the woods somewhere? To me, the salient point here is the frameworks that the cloud is providing you, that Kubernetes is providing you, that Service Mesh is providing you, that Angular is providing you, that Spring Boot is providing you. They define your security posture.
Yes,
and so if you don't understand it, you're not likely. You may be lucky, but you're not likely to make good decisions about how input validation, output encoding, authentication and authorization, encryption, data encoding, data escaping, those things work. And so there's no cheating that hand. You bookended it. You said, look, and I've done the same thing. Like, you know, I'm going to hang out with Rob, you know, Winch for a while, or you know, I can just read the hardening guide, you know, because that's the poor man's version. How do I continuously educate myself in between those bookends? What can I do to make sure that I haven't boiled the ocean and I'm not running a marathon yet, but in 3 months I'll be able to run a 5K?
John, it's the same thing.
I'll be incrementally broke.
You and I, John, I struggle with like extreme obesity all my life. And so I asked you the same question, John, how do I lose weight? And you're like, Jim, you got to do like healthy eating every day and you got to do a little bit of exercise every single day. And I think this the same kind of mental discipline that requires you to lose weight. And hey, baby, John, I did. I lost about.
You six. Did. You look exceptional, by the way. This is not a fool. And please don't. But we get dancing videos of Jim.
What are you doing, John? What are you doing?
And a little demonstration.
Oh, Johnny boy, what are you doing, John? I'm doing a handstand. What are you doing?
I'll spare them.
John, I didn't get to that because I studied spring for a day. I did that because I did yoga every day for half an hour to an hour for a year. And now I'm just like fucking monster, pardon my language. But that's how you do continuing study, John. You got to put a little bit of work and research in every day. Half an hour, 10 minutes, learn something new every day. It's a discipline and it's not easy. And like I like Clint's book. I like Clint's AppSec newsletter. Used to have the best newsletter out of AppSec. Clint's taken that slot over. It's amazing. And so I just dedicate half an hour to an hour every day to exercise and to study a little bit. And I still get my other work done. It's a discipline. And there's no easy answer, John.
I think unfortunately you're exactly correct. at least it seems to me that's the way to do it. Yeah. And I you know, the thing that I've told security people unequivocally, in fact, for those who have worked with me and then left, they know that I say something, you know, very consistently to each and every one of them. Don't be afraid of the development frameworks. Spend the time to dive in and understand them.
I agree.
What I would say to developers is don't be afraid of the security documentation. Don't be afraid to dig into that and just revel in its ambiguity and its trade-offs for a while. And eventually, you know, you'll really gain a perspective that allows you to make decisions on your own.
Understanding the framework is more important than understanding the language. I'll even go that far. The framework is the truth of how you're building apps, and you need that expertise in-house some way, or you're not going to be able to do security or even good development. John, I'm done. John, we did good, John.
I was just about to ask you if you had things that you wanted to tell people that we didn't cover.
I'll tell you what I'm up to. I'm always looking for secure coding training gigs, right? There's a lot of other players in the market. I have like 8 professors now at my company. I'm very proud of the work Manicode does. My other professors to continue doing AppSec. We have a full program. What else is going on, John? I affiliate myself with a lot of different companies, right? Ten Security, they're with Defect Dojo, KSOC with Kubernetes Security, SemGrep with Static Analysis. And someone's going to be mad at me for not mentioning, a new threat modeling company, Aria, is on my radar, and Inspective out of the Middle East, a bug crowd of the Middle East. These are all companies I advise and care about in some way. That's what I'm up to these days, John.
You got a full plate.
Yeah, it's a happy full plate.
That's good.
How about yourself, John? Before we finish up, what about you? What are you up to?
I'm just... really enjoying working with people to mature their security programs and solve these problems. What I find is that, unlike 10 years ago, there are a lot of competent security executives out there, but where they struggle to really hook up and, you know, get velocity or get scale is because they're unable to get the development executives to play from the same sheet of music.
I agree.
And the thing that I find really fulfilling is helping them by crossing the river for them, talking to the development executives in their language and creating co-authoring between the two, a secure SDL that really works for both of them. And to your point,
awesome.
Taking some of the legacy, you know, tools out of the equation, getting, you know, agility, and really getting, you know, security built in because you're adding a paved road, to secure, you know, patterns, to secure components, to lightweight, you know, assurance that those things are there. I'm also advising some security companies and unsurprisingly security companies that are focused on those kind of modalities as opposed to the legacy modalities. And so there's a lot of fun stuff out there. I do think that we are at a very interesting inflection point where we've been saying it's the software, stupid, forever. And we've been saying to security, you have to get into the critical path. And with infrastructure as code, the whole stack, process, infrastructure.
It's all code, baby.
The code itself is all code. And so you can actually reason about a system's design and maintenance, which you could never reason about before. You could only reason about the application. And you can fix it or provide a secure default. And to your point, that is going to allow us a lever that is long enough to move the rock in a way that we simply haven't had it before. And the intersection of that practice in security programs and, you know, and vendors building tools for that purpose is very exciting. We're not there, but we're in the transition period. So I think that's a very exciting place to live, as long as you're not afraid to learn this stuff.
John, I got to tell you, I really enjoyed this conversation. I talk about AppSec a lot. It's one of my favorites. I appreciate taking the time to talk with me. We're done.
I did as well. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your perspective. It's extremely valuable.
Thank you for your questions and your participation, John. I appreciate you a lot, and you know it. Thank you again.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.